This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:21 p.m., Tuesday, March 17, 2026, in Davis 106. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Representatives that are present are Representatives Ruffridge, Fields, Gray, and myself, Representative Mina Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Staffing the committee today, we have Andrew Giannotti as our Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, Kyla Tupo, our LIO moderator, and Katie Giorgio, my committee aide. If you need anything during the meeting, please don't hesitate to get her attention. First up today, we are returning to House Bill 242, Sexual Assault by Healthcare Worker, by Representative Sarah Hannon. Because we were pressed for time for the initial hearing last week, I would like to have Representative Hannon and her staff, Ms. Hunter Meacham, back to the presenter's table to go through the bill presentation and sectional analysis. And I want to note that we also have available for questions Angie Kemp, Deputy Attorney General with the Department of Law, who should be in the room.
Thank you, Chair and Committee, for again taking up House Bill 242, Sexual Assault by a Healthcare Worker. And I'm very appreciative of you being willing at that first hearing to take our invited testimony. I believe that, you know, her testimony was pretty powerful. She'd prepared, and I really wanted her to have that opportunity. So taking it out of order is a little unorthodox, but I think when we talk about the need for this bill, it's important to have the face of a case that pointed out the loophole. And I forgot to start with, I'm Sarah Hannon, and I represent House District 4 that you're currently sitting in. It was a high-profile sexual assault case in this community that exposed this loophole that exists in Alaska's assault laws and resulted in the dismissal of a couple of charges in the case. The sexual assault in the first and second degree by a healthcare worker is limited in definition by a requirement that the offender know that the victim is unaware of the sexual contact during the professional treatment of the victim. House Bill 242, in essence, is a technical cleanup bill. The final passage of this bill would remove this restriction so that victims of sexual assault by a healthcare worker can be aware that the sexual assault is occurring at the time of the assault for those specific charges to be pursued. So it's a very narrow in scope bill looking at our sexual assault statutes only dealing with healthcare workers committing that assault while they are giving treatment. My staff, Hunter Meacham, can run through the sectional for you.
Please proceed.
All right, Hunter Meacham for the record. So just to back up before I do the sectional analysis, I wanted to provide a little context for the original law that passed, that created this statute. So this originated in a comprehensive House Judiciary Crime Bill in 1992, HB 396, also known as the Anti-Violent Crime Act of 1992. Among the many changes in that bill, legislators were closing a gap in the sexual assault statutes, which became apparent during the prosecution of Dr. Ake, an Anchorage gynecologist who pleaded guilty to raping five patients during pelvic exams. The intent was to elevate the level of sex-related crime committed by a healthcare worker during professional treatment of a victim. And before Dr. Ake pleaded guilty, his attorneys argued that the first-degree sexual assault charges required force and that he used no force. His patients were conscious, and while they were being examined, with a cloth draped over them, concealing his actions, he assaulted them. We'll go into the sectional now. Section 1, AS 1141410A, amends the definition of sexual assault in the first degree by a healthcare worker to remove the stipulation that the offender must know that a victim is unaware that a sexual act is being committed. This would result in a victim can be aware or unaware of the sexual contact during the assault. And then Section 2, AS 1141-420A, amends the definition of sexual assault in the second degree by a healthcare worker to remove the stipulation that the offender must know that a victim is unaware that a sexual act is being committed. And again, this change means that a victim can be aware or unaware of the sexual contact during the assault. And Section 3 just means Section 1 and Section 2 only apply to offenses committed on or after the effective date.
Thank you, Ms. Meacham and Representative Hannon. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. I have a number of questions, but I think that they probably would be for the Assistant Attorney General just to ask a couple of law questions. So whenever that would be appropriate, Madam Chair.
Sure. Do we have any other questions for the bill's sponsor at the moment? All right. Seeing none. Ms. Angie Kemp, if you'd like to come up to the presenter's table. The Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law.
Good afternoon. For the record, Angie Kemp, Deputy Attorney General. Ready for your questions.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. I guess my first question is, in this very specific, Representative Hannon describes it as high profile, and I think that was a very accurate description. There's been, I think, questions about whether or not that some of the mistrials or acquittals or some of those things would come forward again for a retrial. Would changing this statute, let's say we did it now, would that prevent those coming forward for a retrial because the statute is different, or prevent the charges that from being changed?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Ruffridge. The answer to that is no, it wouldn't affect the ongoing cases that are out there already, because what you're describing is what we call an ex post facto violation. So you can't, in other words, make something more onerous or criminalize something and have it apply retroactively.
Okay, I have follow-up. If I may. Thank you. From the way I understand it, there was two options in this specific instance to either prove that there was some sort of force or an assault that had happened. And if in the absence of force or assault, you had to then prove that the individual or individuals in that case were unaware of what was happening. And if you couldn't prove unawareness, so that it feels like the word that's key in this bill specifically is unaware. What I think I hear you say is even if we change that now, any sort of thing that moves forward with this very specific instance wouldn't really be affected. Like it wouldn't change at all.
If I may, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, again, I think the answer to that question is yes, as it relates to any ongoing cases.
Okay.
We would be left with or bound to the law as it was and as it applied to him when he committed the conduct. And I just want to be careful. I'm not going – because that is a pending case, I want to be cautious of how much I say about that ongoing litigation. But I think your question is fairly answered here.
Yeah, very much so, and I appreciate it. And I'll move on from that. I don't want to keep putting you in a tough position with that specific thing. One additional question, Madam Chair. Thank you. And I probably could have done some work on this myself offline, but in this particular bill, I guess how does the Department of Law and how do you go about, especially in the case of healthcare, like I think the case that we're talking about here is somebody who, they use physical touch often in their medical profession. How would you prosecute? Let's take that case aside and let's do just hypothetically. How would you define something as what we would call sexual contact or sexual assault in that case? Would we need to maybe adjust our definition of that to apply, or do you think you have the latitude in that case to prosecute very clearly what sexual contact or sexual assault would be in the case of somebody being aware that it's happening but not trying to stop it?
If I may, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge. So if I, what I hear you saying is a couple different things. Right now, there are two separate statutes that define both sexual contact and sexual penetration. So as far as what guidance I would look to for the nature of the conduct, I would be certainly looking to those statutes that inform this statute. So if it was, for example, a sexual assault in the second degree under the theory that it was touching through clothing or touching the bare breasts of a female, for example, sexual contact describes what that is. So it includes touching a female breast through clothing or directly. So I would certainly turn to that statute. But what you might be getting at is that within that statute, it does exempt from sexual contact that contact that's done based upon generally accepted or legitimate medical treatment. So there is challenges, I will say, that are associated with that statute because of that language. There are policy choices this body could make about how to potentially carve that out in a different way. But right now, those two definitions, sexual contact and sexual penetration, exempt from that thing, sexual contact and sexual penetration, when it is a legitimate medical procedure. So I think that answers your question. And if not, I'll make another attempt.
It does. I guess just a follow-up to that, thank you, would be actually, I think that answered it very well. In the case of, let's say you do end up having multiple individuals come forward, there's this sort of case in front of you, would you then have to go through, I guess, their medical records and make the determination in court that the contact that occurred fell outside of what you would call general acceptable medical procedure? I guess my concern is that there seems to still be, even if we were to pass this bill, there seems to be this gray area in there about I want to make sure that if we're going to fix something, that we fix it and that we give you the authority to be able to prosecute in to the highest extent somebody taking, especially in this case, advantage of their position in someone's life. But it seems like there might still be gray area. So how would you go about establishing that it was outside of their medical jurisdiction?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, thank you. That's a great question. That, if I was looking at this particular statute, you've keyed in on the other area of significant litigation, I'll say. So by removing the unaware component, and that's really been largely the subject of case law that we have out there interpreting it, and the primary case that I look to for guidance on the unaware dynamic is a case called Ritter. There was a couple iterations of it. It went up on appeal a couple different times. So that provided some useful guidance to us as prosecutors on dealing with the unaware component. Set that aside for a minute and talk some more about the sexual contact and sexual penetration definitions and the way that they exempt from that those definitions, I'll say legitimate medical care. There certainly are aspects of those definitions that I think that potentially this committee could clean up. For example, I mentioned, I think I said, if I didn't, potentially recasting the exemption of medical, legitimate medical practice and creating as an affirmative defense. In other words, the defense would then be responsible for raising some information and establishing that information at trial. It's a much lower burden. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt, but that's a way that if this body was looking for some ways to adjust maybe some policy on that issue, that potentially is one way that you could do that. Perhaps, so back to your original question, if I were looking this at as a prosecutor, what I would start with is, of course, the unaware dynamic. That tends to be the focus. And then the secondary thing that I would be looking at is, do I need to call medical experts to talk about why this, what happened here, was not a legitimate providing medical care? And so I would probably consult with experts in the field to help me to explain to the jury if it wasn't readily apparent that it wasn't a legitimate medical medical care. So we do tend to rely pretty heavily on expert testimony when there is a dispute about whether the care is appropriate or not. And that does tend to be, the other second most commonly litigated aspect of this particular statute.
Thank you. I guess additional question with that, Madam Chair.
Sure. One more additional
thank
question.
Thank you. Was that a key element in the Ritter matter that you discussed, was bringing forward medical testimony? And if so, how did that end up? Did that end up on the side of the prosecution or not?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, not in the Ritter case. The Ritter case focused on largely unaware and talked about some other statutes that were charged alongside this particular subsection. So it wasn't a central discussion in Ritter. I just know that when we charge these offenses across the state, that tends to be the other area that there is litigation. And when we speak about the case that happened here recently, that was among the things that was discussed significantly.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, just in this line of questioning, as somebody who's done pelvic exams in primary care, in emergency departments, in urgent cares, I have never performed a pelvic exam without a chaperone in the room. No one has a right. The patient doesn't have a right to waive it. I just say that there's a chaperone present. It's part of my training. It's not the law, but you know, there's a chaperone present. And I put it in my medical documentation, the name of the chaperone. Like, you know, whoever it was present for this entire exam. And so to me, when we talk about this sort of crime, I mean, if there's no chaperone in the chart when you were doing a genital exam, that's a red flag because there should have been a chaperone present. And so I think that's relevant to this part of the conversation. I think I know that the cases that we're talking about are different. The case that we're talking about in the case of this bill, the person wasn't performing pelvic exams, but I think if there's concerns about that, I just want to bring it up that it is standard of care, it's standard practice, it's part of your training to always have a chaperone present.
I want to note that we were joined by Representative Prox at 3:28, Representative Schwanke at 3:30, and Representative Mears at 3:38. Do we have any other questions right now from the committee for the bill sponsor or for Ms. Angie Kemp, Deputy Attorney General? All right, and seeing none, we will now continue public testimony on House Bill 242. First off, is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Please come forward to the presenter's table. And please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Christina Love. I'm a resident here in Juneau. my family's from Agegeg Village. I was raised in Chitna. I've been living here in Juneau for 13 years now. I'm a survivor of domestic violence, sexual assault, and trafficking, and I work as an educator. I serve on the advisory council for the United States Council on Trafficking. I was appointed by Biden 2 years ago. My professional expertise is in this area. I do a lot of trauma-informed work and education. And so today I want to testify in strong support of House Bill 242. With the urgency, I really would love to see this pass on its own as a standalone. I want to start by naming that this bill is what this actually is about because the legal language can make it a bit easy to miss. So right now here in the state of Alaska, if a healthcare worker sexually assaults a patient and the patient is awake, if the patient is conscious and fully aware of what is being done, that specific charge of sexual assault by a healthcare worker does not apply. The current law requires that the offender know the victim is unaware. So what that means in practice is that if a patient is alert, who understands what's happening to them, who is terrified and frozen and cannot stop it, may have fewer legal protection than a patient who was conscious. So that is not a technicality. That's a failure of the law to understand how sexual assault actually works. For survivors of sexual violence and educators and people who've worked in this field for a long time, we know something that the law has been slow to catch catch up to. And that is awareness does not equal consent. Freezing does not equal consent. Being too afraid of a person in authority over your body to say stop is not consent. A really important part of this bill is the acknowledgement of the power imbalance that healthcare providers have, which is profound. Patients are in a vulnerable position, often undressed, often in pain, and often alone. And that vulnerability is exactly why we trust healthcare workers with the access to our bodies. And when that trust is violated, the law must be able to hold the perpetrator accountable, regardless of whether the patient was conscious enough to know what's happening. In the recent case here in Juneau, that's a loophole that made it impossible to ignore. So I'm incredibly grateful to Representative Hannon for responding to it. This bill is a direct target fix. It does not expand the definition of sexual assault broadly. It simply removes a restriction that was always unjust. The idea that a victim's awareness of their own assault somehow makes the perpetrator less culpable. I work with survivors every day. I know what it costs to come forward. I know how many survivors stay silent because they believe that the law will not protect them. Because of this, they have been told in ways explicit and implicit that what happens to them does not count. This bill says it counts. This bill says you count, that your experience matters. And whether you knew what was happening or not, whether you froze or that you're fighting or you were fighting somewhere in between, what was done to you was a crime and that Alaska will treat it as such. So I urge this committee, House Bill 242, and survivors are watching, they deserve to know that we are closing the door on what should have never been left open. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Love, for your testimony and for coming here today to the committee.
Quiana.
Do we have anyone else in person who wishes to testify?
Good afternoon. My name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I'm feeling my age today. My husband's 5 years older than me, and we have this running joke. I say, he's old, not me. Today, I feel old. It was over 30 years ago when the gynecologist, Dr. Ake, in Anchorage was raping women in the guise of performing pelvic exams. And because they were unaware, he almost got away with it. So we added to the law, not considering that one day we would need to be back here because a judge would say, she knew it was happening, so it's not sexual assault. I know prosecutorial decisions are made about which fact pattern can be proved, which charge more likely than not will be successful in holding the offender accountable. I know there's a process to be followed. The system failed this time. Most survivors aren't familiar with charging details or specific elements to prove. They know something horrible happened, and they want the person who did it to be held accountable. We need to stop trying to find ways to modify the law so that in certain circumstances, it wouldn't be criminal to have sexual contact or intercourse with a patient. House Bill 242 is clear. If a person is your patient and you're treating them, don't touch them in a sexual way or have sexual intercourse with them when you're treating them. The responsibility for right action is on the professional, the person with power, not the patient. I don't want to be back here years again looking for another way to hold medical professionals responsible for their actions. They have an oath, don't they? First, do no harm. It should be clear and easy to understand that part of that means don't engage in sexual behavior with patients while you're treating them. Please support House Bill 242 and move it from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morton, for testifying and for coming to the committee today. Do we have anyone else in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none, I will look to see if there's anyone online who wishes to testify. And seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Do we have any other questions for the bill sponsor on House Bill 242? At this time, I will be sending an amendment deadline for House Bill 242 for Monday, March 23 at noon. Thank you for coming to the committee today. Next, we are returning to House Bill 292 by Representative Colomb on insurance coverage for PANS/PANDAS treatments. We do have online for this bill available for questions Sarah Lemley with the Northwest PANS Network, Director Heather Carpenter, Division of Insurance, who should be in the room. Oh, there she is. And Ms. Tricia Skitt, Medicaid Program Specialist, over the phone. We'll be working on amendments. We were working on amendments last week, and we paused. Amendment number one was adopted by this committee last Thursday on March 12th. Amendment number two will not be offered. And so now we are on amendment number three, which will be amendment I-4. Representative Gray?
I move Amendment 3.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Representative Mina. So what this amendment does is basically address my concern that I expressed in the last meeting. If you go to I'm looking for the bill. I'm trying to find the bill. Does anyone have the bill?
I have it here in here.
If you go to the bill where it has the list, coverage must include, and it lists a list of treatments, what my amendment would do is add the language, the current standard of care for treatment of pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders associated with streptococcal infections and pediatric acute neuropsychiatric syndrome. So basically my concern that we were putting in, you know, for eternity, that these are the treatments for this particular disease syndrome without acknowledging that there might be new treatments that are developed somewhere in the future and that those should be included. And so it's basically just adding that it must also include the standard of care for treatment because that might be something different in the future.
Thank you, Representative Gray. I have a question for Director Carpenter on this amendment. I'm curious how we do this in Title 21 for insurance coverage for diseases if we are this prescriptive in statute, or are other statutes worded more generally to talk about whatever the current standard of care is for disease?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance. I think we've seen it both ways. It depends on, you know, the legislative policy decision at the time. I don't have concerns with how Representative Gray's amendment structured, and I think that does recognize these things change as we learn more about diseases. So I think there's always a caution of being overly prescriptive in statutes, and then it's much more difficult to keep up with that when practices change, where this would allow insurers to respond more quickly and know the direction you all want it to go in, and it would give the division more tools to recognize when there's new treatment standards.
Okay. Any other questions for Amendment Number 3, Representative Fields?
Well, actually, I'll ask through the chair, maybe not limited to Amendment Number 3, but Ms. Carpenter, I guess I do support the bill, but in looking at a bill like this and any reference to standards of care, are there other conditions that we should be considering as we seek to have expeditious treatment for children? Are there related conditions that we should include under this rubric? If we agree with this logic, are there other conditions that we should list? Thank you.
through the chair, Representative Fields, I'm just not aware of any. I think that would be a question that should go towards, you know, medical providers or parents who have kids who might be facing some of these conditions.
Okay. Well, just through the chair, I guess, I mean, I'm going to support the bill, but that would be my question for the bill sponsor as it goes to the next committee, just to make sure we're being holistic and appreciate the intent of the bill. Thank you.
Rep Fields, did you want to ask any of our available for questions on that?
Sure. Sounds great. Who do you think is the best person to address?
Maybe
that?
We could start with Ms. Sarah Lemley with the Northwest Pandas/PANS Network. Did you hear Representative Fields' question, Ms. Lemley? Could you put yourself on the record and answer it?
Yes, thanks, Chair. My name is Sarah Lemley. I am the Executive Director of the Northwest Panda PANS Network. Thank you, Representative Fields, for that question. I think it's a great question for consideration. As far as we're aware, I'm not aware of other parent advocacy organizations for certain health conditions that are considered more rare. I think you would be made aware of those through advocacy efforts, but we are not aware of any.
Okay, thank you.
I have a quick question just related to this for Ms. Lemley. I mean, are there other conditions that would be addressed through these current therapies and treatment that's listed in the bill, including for IVIG?
Are there other conditions that should be listed? Is that the question, Chair?
Maybe I should rephrase. Are there any other diseases that also would use IVIG? I'm just curious.
To the chair, I think Rep. Gray actually would be a good person to ask that question. And I know that post-COVID, they have used IVIG for MISC, I believe. And I believe that's also covered by insurance.
Rep. Gray?
I'll look up a list, Madam Chair. However, maybe does Representative autoimmune diseases would use it, but okay. Maybe Representative Ruffridge knows off the top of his head.
Representative Ruffridge?
Sorry, Madam Chair, I came in a little bit late. I'm not aware of what we're talking about. So I assume it's Amendment 3, and then there's a question on IVIG.
Yes.
Okay.
If there are other diseases besides PANS or PANS that are addressed by IVIG, but it sounds like there are.
Yes.
Yeah.
Many, many.
Wonderful. Great discussion.
Nice to follow.
Rep Fields?
Since we have a pharmacist here, I guess through the chair, I'm just checking if we're doing this for the PAN and PANS, which I agree with. Should we include other disorders in here that where there's a compelling argument for rapid IVIG treatment?
Representative Ruffridge?
That's a good question. I think specifically when we come down to this bill, I think my IVIG is actually a secondary delay. I think the primary delay is actually diagnosis. And that's typically what you see with most IVIG treatments for a variety of disorders. It's not actually the immediate need for IVIG that is the delay. It's the diagnosis that's a delay. And then you work through what is the treatment, and IVIG then becomes a secondary delay. I tend to lean more on the fact that some of the work we did with a prior authorization bill should help with some of this. Not that I'm opposed to, you know, making it very clear and direct. But if you started listing out potential disorders that needed IVIG, I think the list would be relatively long, and the delay would still be there, and the delay would be in diagnosis. And part of this bill going through, I think, for me even, has been, well, this is something now that we're talking about, hopefully some people are aware, maybe even practitioners or providers might be aware of, you know, don't forget that this is a thing that can occur. Because it's also, although not new, it's relatively new in the lexicon of diagnosis.
Sounds good. Thank you. I appreciate the explanation.
Great. Representative Schwanke and then Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just kind of want to follow up, and I don't know if necessary question, but just something to consider. I don't really fully understand whether this would get us where we want to go. Current standard of care. We're talking about something that is not FDA approved right now to treat this particular brain inflammation issue. So how do you define current standard of care, maybe to the maker of the amendment?
Representative Gray?
Can you please repeat the question? Representative Schwanke, through the chair.
Sure. Current standard of care, my understanding is the IVIG is not, it's used off-label currently for this particular issue because it's not FDA approved for PANS or PANDAS right now. So this, how would we define current standard of care? How would that be utilized if this amendment passed? Would it work to get where we want to go?
Right. So through the chair to Representative Schwanke. I'm not excluding anything in the bill. I'm not taking out anything in the bill. I'm adding to the bill. So if IVIG must be included as it states in the bill, then it is included. I'm adding the standard of care because that's something that could change over time, which could include a medication that we've never heard of. And so what I'm trying to do with the amendment is to make sure that we're not excluding what might be the best treatment at some point in the future. So it's not commenting on what's in the bill, if that makes sense.
Okay, let me follow up with that. Maybe a brief follow-up. Maybe my question wasn't phrased right. What if the next experimental treatment for PANS and PANDAS that comes out is $100,000 per treatment?
Then I believe that IVIG can be that much, and so I think it would include that.
So the amendment,
if the multi-million dollar treatment was the standard of care, then this amendment would require insurance companies to cover that.
What determines standard of care, technically?
If so, I can interject, this might be a great question for Director Carpenter. If you could come to the presenter's table, how does the Division of Insurance interpret the terminology standard of care when they are looking at coverage for different services?
Again, for the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance. We look at the policies and the clinical guidelines that each insurer has adopted. If there are mandates, for instance, in this bill, and you'll see an amendment coming up that I think Representative will help answer your questions. It talks about who is going to set those clinical guidelines, and there's an amendment you're going to consider to make that a little bit more specific. So some of that is looking at groups. For a different example, you know, groups that are setting recommendations for vaccines and such like that. So we really look to who are the professional expertise, and when an insurer maybe say, you know, can come to us, and if we get a complaint from a consumer, we'll look at, did they follow those guidelines on the books? Do they want to appeal? Can the consumer appeal? And I talked about this last week. They can submit final level appeals to the Division of Insurance. We can send that to experts that we have on contract who are independent from the insurers. They can have their clinicians who are peers, so a peer clinician that would have been making the denial per se for the insurance company will be reviewing that to determine, yes, this meets clinical standards or not. So it really is, we try to look to those experts. It's not me as the director making that decision. I am not a clinician, so we're going to really look to what are those clinical guidelines.
Claire's mud.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Well, through the chair to Representative Schwanke, I can tell you how I do it. I use UpToDate, which is a online reference for medical providers that basically, I'm not sure of any medical provider that doesn't use UpToDate nowadays, because it is, in some ways, the most easy go-to. It's there's about 6,000 disease experts who keep the treatment guidelines up to date, and so, and hence the website is called UpToDate. And I mean, I'm there right now. Like, I mean, that's where I go and where I get most of my information. So I would just say that for me personally, that's where I go to. And I think it would be hard pressed to see how most folks wouldn't in some way reference what UpToDate has on there. It's so omnipresent in the medical community.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up?
Well, I appreciate that. I guess I'm not in the medical field, so I'm just really trying to understand how this works and how it works with insurance companies. And so I would feel like this is kind of dangerous language. I guess that's just what I'm trying to say here, in that we would mandate something that we don't know exists yet. And I don't quite know where that bar is, what the current standard of care for something is, especially when it happens to be an off-label use of some drug, if that makes sense. So,
can I ask a question?
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Schwanke. But how is my language of saying follow the standard of care more or less dangerous than saying must include treatment using antimicrobials, medication, behavioral therapies, immunomodulating medicines, plasma exchange, and intravenous immunoglobulin therapy?
We're not talking about the bill. We're talking about the amendment.
Forgive me.
Can I help?
I saw Rep. Mir. What?
He says he thinks he can help where we're at right now.
Rep. Fields thinks he can help.
Through the chair, wanting to try. I think Representative Schwanke, what Representative Gray is saying is that standard of care might be more durable over time as the standard, as the appropriate treatment evolves, and it might keep pace with changing treatments and changing technology better than the current language, which may turn out to be a little bit too prescriptive. And I kind of tend to agree with them.
Ms. Lemley, since you're on the line, could you help provide any additional context for how other states interpret or how other providers, how they interpret the standard of care as it relates to PANDAS and PANS?
Sure. Yeah, many of the states have included language referring to the consortium, the PANS consortium, who are the subject experts. I do agree with Representative Gray that UpToDate is used frequently by providers, and it includes immunomodulatory therapies such as IVIG. And if you all recall, Dr. Angela Tang, who was with us at the last hearing, she did submit some consideration for language changes in order to reference the consortium treatment guidelines as they evolve. And that was sent to, I believe, all the members of the healthcare committee.
All right, thank you. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. I guess I'm still not understanding this, how standards of care are developed, and then what do they mean legally in terms of requiring an insurance provider to pay for something that at this point is not approved by the FDA, but this happens all the time. I'm led to believe that off-label prescriptions happen all the time.
Who are you asking? Or is that rhetorical?
I know something about
this.
Okay. Well, how do you figure out? Well, for the first one, if an insurance company is required to, when are they required to pay for that? If it's if somebody wants to prescribe, see if marijuana works for this disease, and they try it, and sure enough, it works. That doesn't necessarily become the standard. It's not
really. Madam Chair.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you. Shockingly, potentially members of this committee and those listening online may be surprised by Representative Prox's question using marijuana, but it is actually a very acute observation, and one that I have seen from my own personal experience. A young man in my community was diagnosed with seizure disorder, and there was a very specific medication that I won't mention here, but it is directly cannabinoid-related with THC. So it is full-on marijuana in a syrup form. This young person had been normalized to that treatment. And then insurance stopped covering it. And so it had gone through a very long process to try to get it. This was another one of those instances where this prior authorization bill, I think, came into play. And so I think there is a question that Representative Prox is asking that is an important one. It probably is not a part of this bill, though. And I think going back to Amendment Number 3, this idea of standard of care is relatively vague language. I understand why Representative Gray wants to put it in there. I personally don't really – I don't think it affects the bill all that much. I think it probably does help in the durability component of it. I think, to me, the main section of the bill is actually on page 2, number 2, where it starts talking about limiting coverages for immunomodulating therapies. Part of the reason, Representative Prox, that some of these other things that are listed in this bill are relatively unimportant from a coverage perspective is that the majority of these things are cheap and they're available and they're easy. The reason why insurance companies deny coverage almost exclusively is not because it's off-label. It's because it's expensive and they're trying to cut costs. And so what you're seeing here is a bill that's saying, listen, just because it's expensive does not give you the ability to say no or force you to try a whole bunch of things that may or may not work. As we heard in testimony, one of the things that gets tried often is, well, you just have some sort of mental health problem. So we're going to treat you for your mental health problem. Why? That's cheap, really cheap. We're not going to treat the underlying medical condition, which is an inflamed brain, because that's expensive and requires a whole bunch of other avenues of treatment. So I think the standard of care language here, actually in my read of this bill, Section A is sort of like, that's fine, it has to be there. But the main meat of this is actually letter B, number 2. That's the part that really is the important component. I guess that's a long way of saying I'm relatively ambivalent on Amendment Number 3, sort of 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other. I don't think it prevents anything in the future from being used. If some grand thing comes out that changes this dynamic, the odds of it being expensive are maybe pretty high. But we're also seeing that we probably have a treatment now that is effective, and potentially putting that in here in that language would be. But line 2 is going to stay, whether Amendment 3 passes or not. I don't know if that helps.
I guess maybe the underlying question or problem is the standard of care. In the engineering world, there's the National Bureau of Standards, the American Society of, I can't remember what, but anyway, there's groups that establish standards. It would seem until somebody has agreed and written down the standard of care, you can't hold anybody to anything. Because then we run into the problem of unnecessarily turning down the request, the prior authorization. But then the insurance companies and, it would seem, the providers should be held to the same standard of care, the practice. How do you diagnose this, first of all, and then determine that something isn't working? Because if the providers and the insurance companies are being judged by a different standard, I don't know how you uphold that in court. And then in this particular case, and forgive me for not knowing, but in this particular case, it seems like the disease, the disorder, can progress very rapidly. And on the other hand, apparently in some cases, an antibiotic or whatever works, and you should try those things first. And I would think that the physicians would want to try those things first in the same steps and try and do this as quick as we can and get to the right conclusion. And somebody is, would seem to me, would be liable for malpractice, whether it is the insurance company or the provider. There doesn't seem to be a way to sort that out. Or maybe I'm just not understanding how the whole thing works.
And I would say I think that is where prior authorization comes in, the dance between the insurance companies and with the providers of trying to figure out what is the right course of treatment. But Rep. Gray, you look like you would like to respond.
Thank you. So first of all, Chair, this is Zach's binder, Representative Fields' binder, but it happens to have like the whole list of things that IVIG can be used for. So just for the record, for autoimmune mucocutaneous blistering diseases, dermatomyositis, fetal neonatal alloimmune thrombocytopenia, Guillain-Barré syndrome, multifocal motor neuropathy, myasthenia gravis, polymyositis, it goes on and on. There's a long list of things. But what I wanted to point out, and it's in the line of questioning of Representative Prox about things being experimental, and I guess Representative Schwanke, things being experimental are not FDA approved. Being FDA approved doesn't mean insurance covers it. I worked when Jardiance came out and Ozempic, and we were not able to prescribe those at where I was working. Even though we had lots of folks saying this is, you know, Jardiance is the new gold standard for treating diabetes, but it wasn't covered by insurance. So, and then I guess to get to an even bigger, more philosophical problem is like, should high blood pressure be treated? Yes. Every medical provider you find is going to have their different little what they prescribe first and what they prescribe second and what they add together. And as long as you're treating the high blood pressure, you know, no one's telling you that you have to start with lisinopril or that you couldn't start with hydrochlorothiazide. Like you could mix and match. Like medicine, what we're taught is that medicine's an art. So it's a long way of saying you don't decide if somebody's done something wrong because they didn't follow a particular recipe. And I think that actually brings me to the point of why I wanted this more general, non-specific language at the beginning, is because my fear is that we're prescribing a recipe that must be followed. And in so many other aspects of medicine, there's a lot of discretion given to the provider to look at a specific case and decide what is best in this case. And not every provider would make the exact same decision. And that's just part of practicing medicine. So I think that kind of speaks to why do I have this amendment to say that we should follow the standard of care? Because I want something in there that gives a little bit of autonomy to medical providers to do what they believe is best for the patient in front of them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Any other questions for Amendment Number 3? Oh, Representative Prox.
Yeah, sorry to beat this to death, but I can't even remember the name of the drug, I guess it was, for treating COVID. Some people called it a horse dewormer, and somebody called it a miracle for treating
ivermectin.
Ivermectin, thank you. And it would seem sort of to be the same debate. Some people think it works, but there is no authority that said, yep. And we're opening the door. An unsolvable debate. And if it is, well, in this case, there's apparently relatively inexpensive, and I can see the insurance company saying, yeah, have you tried that first? Because they have to have some way of controlling the cost. Otherwise, insurance becomes unaffordable. I don't know. Maybe there isn't a good answer to that, and we'll have to keep debating it.
That sounds like a great philosophical question.
It is.
I remove my objection to amendment number 3.
I object.
Okay, Representative Ruffridge objects. Rep. Ruffridge?
I just wanted to see, again, I was not here when we moved Amendment 3. I apologize. I wanted to see if we had heard from the bill sponsor on Amendment 3.
Oh, we have not. Representative Colom, would you like to provide your comments on Amendment number 3?
Yeah, so for the record, I'm Julie Colom, representing House District 11. So I really don't have a particular issue with the amendment. I think the email that I got from Ms. Lemley, I thought her version was probably a little bit better because it has, you know, just a little bit. You get to keep it, but it says, you know, including but not limited to, and then you keep the listed treatment. So I prefer that, but I'm not against this amendment.
Representative Ruffridge, do you maintain your objection?
Well, I do. Including but not limited to certainly seems short. It actually just seems, I'm sorry that my English major is coming out, Rep. Gray, but it seems like a better sentence. Thoughts? I mean, I don't know. Now we're just debating English points.
Madam Chair.
Rep. Gray.
Thank you. So through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, so you wanted to say including the standard of care of treatment, but not limited to the standard of care. Can you read the sentence as you believe it should be read?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair.
Rep. Ruffridge.
I think it would say coverage.
I see.
Coverage may include, but is not limited to, treatment using antimicrobials, medication, behavioral therapies, not all the way down to immunoglobulin therapy. Coverage must include, but is not limited to.
So, thank you. Through the chair. So, that's interesting, because I was thinking that you were saying including, but not limited to, the standard of care, but you actually have it coming after that. I'm fine. I'm fine with that.
Brief at ease. You want to do like... Back on the record, Representative Ruffridge.
I'll maintain my objection, Madam Chair.
All right. Would the clerk please call the roll?
All right. For Amendment number 3, Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
No.
Representative Schwanke.
No.
Representative Mears.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Co-Chair Mina?
Yes, Chair.
All right. Amendment 3 has... five yeas and two nays.
On a vote of five yeas and two nays, Amendment number 3 has been adopted. Amendment number 4 and 5 will not be offered. Now to Amendment number 6, Representative Gray.
Amendment number 6 will not be offered.
All right. We are done with amendments. Is there any further discussion on House Bill 292? Seeing none, I would now entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Chair Mina, I move House Bill 292, Work Order 34-LS1209/I, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached indeterminate fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 292 passes from committee, and we will take a brief at ease to sign the committee report. Back on the record.
Sort of.
Today we have the initial hearing for House Bill 150 on child trafficking screening by Representative Sarah Vance. If Representative Vance and her staff, Isaiah Smardo, would please come to the presenter's table, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Ooh,
feels like an extra long. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 150 today. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Vance, honored to represent House District 6. I'm here today to introduce House Bill 150, a bill designed to strengthen protections for Alaska's most vulnerable children by improving how we identify youth who may be victims of exploitation or trafficking. Throughout my work in the legislature, I've seen some troubling data that show how vulnerable Alaskan children are, especially those in foster care, juvenile justice, and the youth shelters. National research tells us that up to 60% of child sex trafficking victims have been in foster care, and many of the providers believe that in Alaska that number could be up to 80%. And about one-third of at-risk youth report running away or being expelled before trafficking occurs. While these numbers are national, they reflect risk patterns we see here in Alaska. In Alaska, the situation is especially concerning. FBI-based data show that Alaska has one of the highest human trafficking rates per capita in the country, roughly six times the national average. By the age of five, about 40% of Alaskan Native children have had contact with Child Protective Services. Again, one of the highest in the nation. The National Human Trafficking Hotline reported eight cases in 2022 involving 18 victims, and in 2023 there were 22 cases involving 44 victims in Alaska. Child sexual assault rates in Alaska are nearly six times the national average, and research shows that one in seven children will experience an allegation of sexual abuse before the age of 12. Youth in foster care, juvenile justice, and runaway or homeless youth programs face heightened risks. Many have experienced trauma, abuse, instability, and lack of protective supports. The more adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, a child has, such as neglect, abuse, household instability, or exposure to violence, the more vulnerable the child becomes to exploitation. And in this committee, I know that many of you are highly aware that Alaskan children face some of the highest level of ACEs in the nation as well. Traffickers understand this. They look for vulnerabilities. They target youth who lack stable housing, consistent adult protection, or a safe support system. Every time a high-risk youth interacts with our systems is an opportunity to identify and protect them. Unfortunately, many of those opportunities are currently being missed. Today in Alaska law, there is no statutory requirement for trafficking screening in several key systems. The Office of Children's Services does not have a statutory requirement to conduct trauma-informed trafficking screening for children in foster care. Juvenile justice agencies are not required to screen youth for trafficking or exploitation. Youth shelters serving minors are also not required by statute to use any structured screening tool to identify trafficking victims. This means a child could be in foster care, a juvenile facility, or a youth shelter, and no one is explicitly required in state law to screen that child for trafficking or exploitation. That is the gap that House Bill 150 closes. Now, some may ask, why is this necessary if federal law already addresses trafficking? Congress passed the Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act in 2014 and tied those requirements to federal foster care funding under Title IV-E. Through these programs, Alaska receives roughly $60 to $70 million annually in federal child welfare funding. These funds support the very systems responsible for protecting vulnerable children. States receiving these funds are expected to have policies to identify and respond to trafficking among youth in their care. However, in Alaska, these expectations have largely been implemented through policy rather than statute, meaning screening practices are inconsistent and not uniformly required across systems. For example, in the Office of Child Services, they only ask two questions when it comes to exploitation. They ask, has someone touched you inappropriately, and have you traded sex for anything of value? House Bill 150 moves Alaska from nominal compliance to meaningful implementation. It ensures that trafficking screening happens consistently across agencies and with clear accountability. Specifically, the bill requires comprehensive trafficking screening for all children in foster care and youth returning from missing or runaway episodes, often where The trafficking happens when they're the most vulnerable. It extends mandatory screening to youth in the juvenile justice system and establishes a uniform screening tool and procedures developed or adopted by the Department of Family and Community Services so agencies and shelters use a consistent evidence-based process. It requires tracking, reporting, and appropriate follow-up services, ensuring youth identified at risk are connected to safe placements, counseling, and protective resources. Because agencies already conduct some form of screening and practice, this bill does not create an entirely new process. Instead, it codifies and standardizes best practices that should be already happening. For this reason, the fiscal note is zero, and implementation fits within existing frameworks. I've seen firsthand how effective structured screening tools can be. For instance, Covenant House does a fantastic job on screening, and they've implemented a standardized trafficking screening protocol, and in 1 year they identified 27 trafficking victims who might otherwise gone unnoticed. These tools help professionals identify victims earlier, connect them with services, and ensure resources directed where they are most needed. Members of the committee, early intervention saves lives. Alaska already has some of the highest rates of child welfare involvement in the nation, which means we also have a unique opportunity and a responsibility to protect youth before exploitation occurs or worsens. HB 150 will not solve the entire problem of trafficking and exploitation, but it ensures that when the vulnerable youth most of you at the table know more than other members because you hear in this committee how our children need us to stand up for them so desperately. Our children experience the worst abuses and sexual assault in the nation that is off the charts. When the children come into our care in the state, we have a moral duty to do everything that we can to help them exactly where they're at. And most of them come to us already have experienced the most heinous abuses and trauma. Right now, we are failing as a state for these children. We are not screening them in the way that we should. There are organizations in the state like Covenant House, My House, and others who do have a robust screening tool. They are asking the questions that are age-appropriate and trauma-informed that will identify if these children are being exploited. The state is not. We have a duty. We are taking federal dollars that 12 years ago said that we would do better. And I don't believe that we've done better, because we have not turned that dial. Our foster kids who were here will tell you those stories. They don't feel that the state is doing our duty to help them. This bill is one tool. I don't tell department how to make the screening tool. What it says is work with the organizations who have the boots on the ground who are doing a fantastic job screening, because we should have a screening tool that we don't handpick from another state. It needs to be specific to Alaska and the needs of our children. So this bill simply says, no, you have to do it. Work with the organizations who are interacting with the children every day, and let's improve that so that we can help them, the children that we already have in our care. I've asked Michelle Overstreet from My House to be invited testimony today, and she works with the youth day in and day out and has a fantastic job and can talk to you about the relevance of a great screening tool and how it can help our children. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vance. I'll turn over to the invited testimony now. Ms. Michelle Overstreet, could you please unmute, put yourself on your record, on the record, and begin your testimony?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, great. Thank you. I'm Michelle Overstreet, founder and CEO at My House in Wasilla. And we are a nonprofit in the Madison Valley dedicated to helping homeless youth build stable, independent lives. And we serve young people between the ages of 14 and 25, each with a story marked not by deficiency, but by resilience and potential. We believe that our youth are assets, not liabilities. HB 150 is more than a policy proposal. It's really prevention. It strengthens the protective factors we know keep young people safe, healthy, protected, and connected. When youth experience unreported exploitation, there is a lot of shame around admitting that they've traded sex for food or a place to stay or safety. And when they're able to talk about that, it can lead them to healing, to transformation. When they experience unreported exploitation, it contributes to untreated mental illness and ultimately chronic poverty. Many, many of the older youth that we serve that really struggle getting out of homelessness and poverty are victims of sexual exploitation and trafficking. Our average age of somebody reporting trafficking is 18, which means that they've already kind of been through it, and 14% overall of our entire client's population reports having experienced that. And again, our numbers are some of the highest in the nation. When we ensure consistent access to people asking the right questions, using a screening tool can allow us to have somebody say, yes, I did experience that, and then they can go to the next level in terms of having somebody with lived experience in our building, it's called a peer support worker, come alongside them and say, hey, wow, I know how you feel. I felt that same way. This is what I found, and help walk them out of that instead of it just going unnoticed. And then they end up leaving the program. Or even worse, somebody who has victimized them in the past, a pimp, a quote, boyfriend, unquote, drives up to the drop-in center, comes in or calls them from the car, and they drive away with that person and we never see them again. Those are the most at risk for death. And we do see that. If we can ensure this consistent access to safe housing, supportive adults, education, and behavioral health care, the outcomes completely reverse. When a young person has a trusted and knowledgeable case manager, a bed they can rely on, and people that know what they've experienced, they begin to heal. Without that knowledge, without that screening tool, without that initial information about what we're really looking at, it completely changes. When they can access outpatient treatment or supportive programs, they begin to dream again. These are the protective factors in action, and HB 150 aims to make them standard, not exceptional. If we don't know their trauma or risk, we can't offer appropriate services, and it makes safety more difficult. Our state has made remarkable strides in responding to homelessness, but Alaska's youth still face unique barriers. Many are couch surfing, living in vehicles, or trading sex for survival. And without policy that explicitly supports best practice screening, we risk losing those vulnerable youth to trauma and for trafficking. This bill aligns with best practice models nationally and locally. It complements the My House Hand Up, Not a Handout approach by investing in transition, helping youth move from crisis to contribution. And for every dollar spent on safety and stabilization, our communities save exponentially in emergency response, incarceration, and healthcare costs. We know this. Far more importantly, we keep young people in our classrooms, our workforce, and in our future communities. I would urge you to pass HB 150 as a commitment to Alaska's young people that no matter where they come from or what they've survived, They deserve safety, stability, and a chance to thrive. Thank you for your time and your continued dedication to protecting Alaska's youth. And thank you, Sarah Vance, for introducing this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Overstreet, for your testimony. Do we have any questions or discussion on House Bill 150? Representative Prox?
Do we have additional invited testifiers?
We do not.
Okay, very good. So, yes, through the chair, is there now a standard of care? We're just saying do something. Do something. But is there a standard set of questions that has been tried and recognized by some sort of standard-setting agency? I don't know, or the best we can, close to that.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, yes, many other states have adopted a universal screening tool. However, when I first introduced this bill and talked to the Department of Family and Community Services, they felt that it would be best to not have one prescriptive in statute, but for them to have flexibility in developing that tool for that was specific to Alaska and also specific to the age groups and departments that the children would be interfacing with. So there is a standard. However, and I can provide examples to the committee in, for future reference if you like, but you're not seeing that at the moment because of adhering to the request by the department.
Follow up.
Yeah, I guess that seems unacceptable to me that we wouldn't adopt some sort of standard. Are we going to have a discussion with Family Services, I guess, as to why they might adopt something other than a standard and what they're proposing to do? I guess I would like to hear their justification for doing something other than what appears to be widely accepted as working in, how did you say, 16 other states or something like that.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, my apologies. There is a universal trafficking screening. It is not currently adopted, but there is one, and that's what the bill is saying that we need to develop.
Follow up. Family Services has something that they're proposing to do, something in mind already.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I am unaware of the department having any plan to change from their current practice. That's why the bill exists.
Well, we'll have to think about that. And then this is...
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
I'm sorry. This is just applying to Office of Child Services, not my house or some other shelter.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, this applies to Office of Children's Services, Juvenile Justices, and any youth shelter.
That being, I'm sorry, follow up. That would be a youth shelter not operated by the state.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, the intent of the bill is any state interaction with children would require the screening, but it is specifically addressing the language also addresses the youth shelters who receive state funding as well as any child services within the state.
Okay. And then another follow-up. I guess. Then would the shelters, my house, the one I'm thinking of in Fairbanks is The Door. I think there's a few others. they would be required to somehow certify that they have that training and they're following it. In addition, I think they're required to have, mandatory reporting training, but this would be in addition to mandatory reporting training.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, it is my understanding that several, if not all, of the shelters do have some form of intake already, a screening form. But it is not currently statutorily required, and it's not universal, meaning they aren't asking the a minimum of similar questions. I know that Covenant House currently does. I know that my house does. And there are there's currently four youth shelters. So I know firsthand that two of them have robust trafficking screening tools. So this would only expand and make sure that it is meeting a minimum standard across the state. This also helps for data collection for the Governor's Council on Human Trafficking so that we can understand what the trafficking looks like that is happening with our youth and types of exploitation so that we can better find a solution.
I have a quick question before Representative Gray. Are there any changes between this bill and House Bill 264 from the 33rd legislature?
Madam Chairman, no. This is the work of the bill that you were in the committee that you were in last.
Great. Thank you. Representative Gray?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Vance, can you remind us, what were the two you read two questions that I guess, are those the two questions that are currently asked? And can you remind me what the questions are and what organization?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, it is my recollection that the two questions that are being asked is, has anyone touched you inappropriately, and have you traded sex for anything of value? And I believe that is the Office of Children's Services questions. They do have other questions that they ask, but those are specific to trafficking and exploitation.
Follow-up. So in the Army, when we do our suicide screen, so every year you get a periodic health assessment, and I, as a medical provider, did, I don't know, probably thousands. But we would have to do the suicide screen, and it was a question that we had to read verbatim. I'm kind of embarrassed that I won't get it exactly right, but it was something along the lines of, in the last 30 days, have you had any thoughts of hurting yourself or that you would be better off dead? That's the question that we would do. Everybody got asked that question, and I would literally say, I have to read this question exactly as it appears, and I would read it, and if they said no, then they have successfully passed the screen for suicide and they are not flagged as being suicidal and they move on with their lives. And so I guess in general, our tool was a single question. So I'm curious about what's considered enough questions to be a robust tool? How many questions, and I think it might vary based on how old the child is as well. So I'm just curious a little bit more about how we define what's enough and whether and how we say what they're currently doing is inadequate.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, two questions regarding exploitation, in my mind, is not getting to the bottom of the issue. We're not learning what's happening with that child. That's why I find it unacceptable. Apparently, because the state continues to receive the federal funding to the tune of roughly $70 million a year, the federal government must say, that works. However, we know that the exploitation of our youth has only increased. So therefore, in my mind, we're not doing a very good job. When you look at the intake, the screening tools that are being implemented by Covenant House, my house, they are more conversational and they are age appropriate. And that's why I'm not being very prescriptive in the bill, because I want the flexibility within the department to say, okay, this is the screening tool that we're going to use on small children. that is a conversation that maybe can find out on their verbal language that's trauma-informed as well, on finding out, are they being exploited? What's happening? It'll be a very different conversation than with a 15-year-old. A 15-year-old, you might ask the question, do you have any tattoos? Who gave... Did you get that tattoo yourself? What is it? Why do you have it? Those are indicators that might identify if you have a pimp. And those are very different questions than, have you traded sex for anything of value? And so that's why I believe there needs to be so much more. However, if we get prescriptive in statute, we're limiting the flexibility of the department to really work on the best approach in the different circumstances and age groups that they will be interfacing with.
Follow up. Thank you. Again, using my Army analogy, if someone said yes, like all they said was, yes, I've had thoughts of hurting myself or that I'd be better off dead, then that's a positive screen. And then they would go see the mental health person, and then there would be a lot more questions. So I'm curious, it's probably more of a question for the department, but when someone says, yes, I have traded sex for something of value, I'm curious to know what the follow-up is. Because I assume that if your bill is passed, that the follow-up would also be something. Well, I guess the question, does your bill address what happens if there's a positive screen? If somebody is screened for sex trafficking and they say yes, or it's found that this person is likely being sex trafficked?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, those policies should already be in place with the Office of Child Services or Juvenile Justice. And currently within the shelters, we do have some systems in place. Likely they might need counseling. The number one issues is housing. Often, as you heard from the testifier from Michelle Overstreet with My House, is we have a lot of couch surfing going on, and they will trade sex to be able to have a place to sleep that night and get out of the weather. That is a common statistic that I hear, an answer that I hear among the homeless youth. And that's kind of the beginning of their exploitation journey. That to me is an abomination that we have Alaskans who would do that to our youth. So just starting with the basic services. So this bill does not go beyond requiring a statutory framework to get them to do what I believe they should be doing. This says you should already have these systems in place, and this bill is just one step in that process, because when it comes to helping prevent trafficking and exploitation of our children, our state is woefully behind.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee? Representative Brooks?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, somewhat nebulous. If someone is trading sex for shelter, not necessarily trafficking. Maybe. Because in my mind, the primary job of the state government, a government, would be to find and prosecute the perpetrators first, just the way I thought government used to work, as opposed to, not that I'm not compassionate, but the first responsibility of government, of governing, is to govern that activity rather than provide assistance to the victim. Now, I understand that there might be some responsibility to provide assistance as well, but we're not getting down to the core of the problem, which is the perpetrators. And should we be focusing on that if somebody determines that this individual has been trafficked? Should there be some further action taken to try and identify the perpetrators?
Through the chair, Representative Prox. All of the the people who will be interacting with the children, the minors who come into our state care, and also in the youth shelters, are all mandatory reporters. So if they have been screened and the flags are raised that they are potentially being exploited or trafficked, they would then be referred for further investigation. And if they can identify a perpetrator, that would be handed over to law enforcement to be able to pursue that. But what this bill does is it first establishes the screening tool that asks the questions, because we can never find the perpetrator if the victim doesn't, through these series of questions, identify that they were ever exploited in the first place. Mm-hmm. The bill specifically identifies it what commercial sexual exploitation is. It means the sexual abuse or exploitation of a child for the financial benefit of any person or in exchange for anything of value given or received by any person, meaning the value of a warm night stay over they needed a couch to sleep on, a room for the night that has value. That would be prosecutable under our other laws, which that's a whole other day, because I want to strengthen those laws too, but they do exist. But the screening tool acts as a first step in being able to talk, because most victims of abuse and exploitation do not ever tell about their abuse. Mm-hmm. Maybe one third. So the numbers that I gave you earlier about the level of exploitation is what we know in the state, which is six times the national average. It's only what we know. By simply asking the questions through this screening tool, we will then be able to bring that justice, as we should as a state. But it's also just as important to be able to help these children right where they're at so that they're not further exploited. Mm-hmm. This is stopping exploitation before it goes any further.
Okay. Representative Schonke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rip Vance, for bringing the bill. I have some numbers in front of me from OCS the last 5 years. Substantiated allegations. These are OCS numbers. Sexual abuse from 2021 to 2025. 272, 263, 186, 250, and 277 children in OCS's care in 2025 were sexually abused. Do you think that your bill will help reduce those numbers?
Through the chair, Representative Schonke, unfortunately, I don't think that it would help reduce that, because by the time the children come into OCS care, they've often been abused, and that's why they're there. We know that continued abuse often does happen. What I'm hoping is that it will prevent further abuse and further exploitation, because we know that the children who are in foster care are not often in the most perfect circumstances and not in perfect homes. It's often when they run away that they are open to exploitation by people who are seeking the vulnerable. It can't stop everything, but hopefully it can slow it down and stop that cycle of abuse that many children who undergo abuse and exploitation find themselves in. I'm hoping that it will end that.
Quick follow-up. I think your bill will reduce these numbers. These are allegations of kids that are in OCS care. So if the screening tool identifies vulnerable children potentially coming into the OCS system, then hopefully that will thwart any additional opportunity for them to be taken advantage of. So I just want to say thank you. I like your bill.
Thank you.
Yeah. I have a question, just looking at this bill again. So I'm on page 2, so I'm on section 4, which is, and looking specifically on page 2, lines 20 through 21. And my understanding is that it's specifically DFCS that's developing the screening tool, and they would monitor and collect this information. I know that the Governor's Council on Human and Sex Trafficking is housed in DPS, and I'm sure they are doing a lot of work in terms of tracking information. And so I'm wondering why DFCS would be collecting this information, and if there's a way to promote more interagency collaboration between the two, given that DPS has been doing so much work on trafficking.
Madam Chairman, I would love that. But it does start with the department by collecting and utilizing that information. However, I regret to inform you that the Governor's Council on Human and Sex Trafficking has not met for the past 2 years. I'm an ex officio member, and my summation is that it is due to capacity within the department. 2 years ago, we gave them a mandate to work on VAWA and the missing and murdered Indigenous women, and we provided them investigators to do that. And I believe that's where a lot of the attention has gone. My concern is that council is only by administrative order. However, the way this bill is written that says the method shall support the trafficking information gathering and efforts in the state is that whether a council is by administrative order or statute or just simply lies within the department, that the data will be collected so that it can be utilized for federal funding, and also so that we can learn more about trafficking and the impacts in the state. The department does have to have some sort of data in order to receive the funding that for the Title IV-E.
And do you have an understanding, because I don't, of how that federal funding, that Title IV-E funding, is linked to data from these screening tools?
Madam Chairman, I was looking at that prior to the hearing, trying to understand. It says that the federal requirement is that they have to adopt a trafficking screening tool in order to receive the funding. But I don't know how. They obviously have not, either have not followed up with that, or we are compliant, because I'm not seeing any changes beyond the initial bill that was passed in 2014 saying that we need to have it.
Okay. I would love a little bit more follow-up information on those federal requirements, just because I'm curious about that funding. Since you're an ex officio member on the Governor's Council, are you aware of what trafficking data that DPS collects or engages in? I'm just trying to figure out how they can help support DFCS, because we know that DPS's capacity is limited, but we also have heard a lot of hearings about how DFCS's capacity has been limited as well. So I just want to make sure that these agencies are working together to make sure that we're helping to support youth that are being screened positively on these tests.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing to keep in mind with this bill is that they already have a screening tool, but the intent is that they expand the trafficking and exploitation and have it universal across the department and the youth shelters. Because when DPS and the department are utilizing data and they're trying to get a picture of the exploitation, the trafficking that's happening, it's been a challenge to cause the data to line up and really understand the big picture, because whether the different non-governmental organizations and DPS and Department of Family and Community Services may ask different questions. They have different information. And that's the work that the Trafficking Council has been working on, is gathering that data and trying to make sense of it and represent it well. So there is a report. I believe that the Trafficking Council did put out a 2024 report, if I remember that accurately, and it is working across these different NGOs and departments to try to get that snapshot. But that's been one of the challenges and why it's taking so long is because of the different definitions and questions that are being asked. This bill would require at least the within our state departments and within the youth shelters to start at a minimum so that we can have that information.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? All right, seeing none, we will hold House Bill 150 for now. Thank you, Representative Vance and staff, for presenting today. The next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Standing Committee will be Thursday, March 19 at 3:15 p.m. The time is 5:05 p.m., and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.